I'm joined on Radio Jackie today by the Liberal Democrat MP for Epsom and Yule, Helen Maguire. Jumping straight in with obviously the recent talks about Ukraine and Russia and the support for Ukraine. You've called for increasing UK defence spending to 3% of GDP. Where should this funding be prioritised, do you think?
So at the moment, the government's doing the strategic defence review. And this review is effectively assessing where the armed forces is right now, and also looking at the capabilities that we need for the future. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening at the moment is that warfare on the battlefield is fundamentally changing, and it's changing from the conventional warfare that we've seen in the past. There's a lot more, for example, drone technology that's been used. And one of the things that we're seeing that we've never seen before, for example, is that more individuals are being killed through drones than they are through the conventional warfare. So taking all of that into account, what I hope the Strategic Defence Review will achieve is actually a better analysis of what capabilities the armed forces actually need. So I think it's a little too early on to say exactly what we need. But one of the things that I know would be very helpful is absolutely to have a few more troops and to reverse the Conservative 10,000 troop cuts. Because whatever happens, we are definitely going to need more personnel. Exactly in which service, I don't know. It's going to depend where the priorities are. So hopefully we'll gain some more insight from that once the review's been conducted.
And how feasible is redirecting £40 billion in frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine?
It's absolutely feasible, and it's something we've been calling for a very long time, and it's something that some other countries have led on, and we've been calling for not only the interest from the Russian frozen assets to be used, but also the assets themselves. I mean, we have examples, for example, just in our county here in Surrey, in Woking, where there are houses of various individuals that are just sat there and they haven't been sold yet. So there's lots of examples of assets that can be used very quickly, and we just need the government to prioritise using them.
With US support now uncertain, how should the UK and its allies adjust their assistance?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really tough week. It's been a really difficult week, and a week that we have seen scenes that I guess we never would expect that we would see in the Oval Office. And I think as a result of that, as much as the US has been our closest ally, it's also been a time where we've recognised that we've really got to start to, stand up for ourselves. And the UK's got to lead with this with our European allies. And it was interesting to hear Ursula von der Leyen yesterday at the European Commission announce a method now where European countries can actually spend more on defence. So I think it's been a wake-up call, and I think Europe has needed that. Many countries haven't been spending the 2% GDP defence commitment that they actually, we're meant to within NATO. And, I hope this wake-up call now means that more European countries are, taking the defence seriously and spending the money on defence that they need to make sure that the aggressor, Russia, quite frankly, can't win in Ukraine, because we've had so many brave Ukrainian soldiers who've now fought for so long, and we really need to make sure that we have a just peace for the sovereign nation of Ukraine.
Now, you've called Trump's stance on Ukraine a betrayal. How do you think his position will impact the UK's security and NATO's unity?
Well, it's been really interesting. I mean, this is a type of diplomacy we haven't seen before. We've seen Trump remove US aid. We've also seen Trump now say that even the UK can't share any US intelligence with Ukraine. And quite frankly, this is going to have absolutely deadly consequences on the battlefield. It's obviously we need to continue to work with the US. That's incredibly important. As I mentioned, they are our closest ally, and we share a huge amount of intelligence. And, many of our kind of military equipment is intertwined with US. So obviously we have to continue to work with them. And they still are a member of NATO. They'll continue to be that. But I think it's a new chapter, and it's a different way of working with them. And that's something that this government, that Keir Starmer, is going to have to figure out how he can best achieve that.
And you are a former captain in the Royal Military Police. Can you just, first of all, explain to people in layman's terms, what was your position?
So I was a captain in the Royal Military Police. So that meant a number of different things. We had a role in the UK, and we had a role on operations. So fundamentally, the military police, what they do is they police the armed forces. but on operations we have other roles. So in when I was based in Iraq, for example, we were retraining the Iraqi police force, and we were also providing support to the infantry. So when they're out on patrol, we would be doing the search and arrest operations, for example.
And how has your experience in the Royal Military Police shaped your views on Ukraine's defence strategy?
Well, look, I think if you've been heavily involved in any particular employment, you have a deeper understanding of the impact and the effects that certain decisions make. And, so I deeply understand and know how, Ukrainian soldiers might feel on the battlefield, particularly if they haven't got the equipment that we need. When I was stationed in Mazar-i Aqaba in Iraq, very sadly, a year before I arrived, six of my fellow members from my regiment were murdered. And, part of that, was possibly because they didn't have the right equipment. And following that, the British government did give British soldiers far more equipment. So I've been there. I understand exactly the impact that these consequences can have. It just helps me understand, the impact that these decisions can make.
And what lessons can the UK military take from this conflict to strengthen its own defences?
The lessons are, as I mentioned earlier, the type of war that's being fought right now on the front line is very different to what's happened before. And we need to learn the lessons from the soldiers on the front line, from those who are developing the new type of capability, so that we're prepared for this new warfare. I mean, the front line now has extended so much further because of the capability of the military equipment that we have right now. So that close war is actually much deeper than it ever has been before. And so we've got to, rapidly learn those lessons. And I think there's lots of interesting insight, for example, for our procurement industry, our defence procurement industry, because on the front line in Ukraine, they've had to rapidly turn around and develop equipment in a matter of weeks. They haven't had years to do that. And so we as a, the military defence industries have got to work, closely with government to certainly be a lot more agile in circumstances like these, where new technologies need to be developed very rapidly. And these sort of kind of 10-year procurement situations won't help in situations like this.
Moving on to the recent debate on energy costs, how are pensioners in Epsom and Yule being affected by the removal of winter fuel payments?
Massively. I've received so many emails from so many pensioners who are so incredibly frustrated that they've had their winter fuel payment removed. And it's even more, difficult for them now that the energy bills have increased by 6.4%. So these individuals who are already vulnerable in our community are being affected even more. And, again, where many pensioners are having to choose between heating or eating. And it's just really disappointing. And we need to find ways to, better stabilise our energy market, so the prices don't continue to hike in such a way and have such an impact on the most vulnerable in our community.
And why do you think the government should scrap the latest energy bill rise for pensioners specifically?
Well, it's specifically the pensioners who've had their winter fuel payments removed. Vulnerable individuals in the community who need this funding, who have, planned to have this funding involved, and they've only got so much income. So that limited income will only go so far. So, as I mentioned before, they have to make this choice between heating and eating. And that's not something that we should be expecting our pensioners today to do.
And has the government done enough to tackle rising energy costs? If not, what should change?
No, I don't think they have. And I mean, one of the things that one of our Lib Dem MPs put forward, for example, was the Sunshine Bill. And this was a bill that would make sure that all new homes would have solar panels on them. We need to make sure that our houses are better insulated. And if there used to be lots of discounted insulation that people could put into their homes, and these sort of opportunities aren't around at the moment. So fundamentally, if we have a better housing stock, then that will bring energy bills down, and we need investment in that to make sure that it's far cheaper to heat our homes.
And what more can local councils and communities do to support struggling people?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're doing a lot already, and obviously that's very welcome. I mean, I help out at the local food bank, so that's one way that they're supporting, and And obviously there are various funds that are available for different people if they have any need. And there's lots of advice cafes that people can go to try to help them with their energy bills. And, you know, I think one of the things that people, you know, can do is obviously look at their energy company and have a look out on the markets and see if there are better options out there. And certainly the advice cafes, the Citizens Advice Bureau, you know, can assist with these sort of things.
Next topic I want to talk about is Thames Water demanding higher bills. Why do you believe Thames Water should be blocked from raising bills while their services are failing?
Well, look, at the moment we have this situation where they have so much debt that a third of the bills is actually just going to pay the interest from the debt. And not only that, but Thames Water now are seeking more debt because they haven't got enough cash flow to actually run the company. So we don't think it's right that they effectively should be increasing bills when we know that some of that money is effectively just going to service the debt. And at the same time that that's happening, you know, they're still failing to fix the leaks in the pipes. They're still polluting the rivers, the River Mole and the Hogsmill. And, you know, it's really just not fair that bill payers have been penalised for the failures of Thames Water.
Yeah. And how can the government better hold water companies accountable for financial mismanagement and sewage dumping?
Well, look, Ofwat needs to have stronger teeth. It doesn't have strong enough teeth at the moment. So we've been calling for a new organisation, a new regulatory body that will have stronger teeth. And obviously with Thames Water, we've been calling for it to go into special administration as soon as possible, because fundamentally, you know, the company's not functioning properly and it's not serving its customers well at the moment.
And what immediate steps should be taken to protect customers from rising water bills?
Well, look, I mean, one of the things that we're doing at the moment, you know, our Lib Dem MP, Charlie Maynard, is in court with Thames Water at the moment, you know, making sure that Thames Water can't get the additional money that they would like to effectively bail them out and to go into special administration. So that's what we've been calling for the government to do, is to put them into special administration. So that's what we'd like.
And how can local communities and MPs like yourself push for real change in the water industry?
Well, we've been doing that. I mean, I've been meeting with Ofwat, I've been meeting with Thames Water, we've been holding the government to account. And as I mentioned, what we need is a new regulator, and a regulator that's actually got proper teeth, that can actually, is actually going to penalise the Thames Water companies, the water companies, you know, when they pollute into the rivers and when they're not investing in the infrastructure as they should be doing.
Moving on to the rise in rail fares, why should rail fares be frozen, and how are rising prices affecting commuters in Epsom and Ewell?
Look, I think it's really difficult for commuters in Epsom, Ewell, Ashdead and Leatherhead, because since COVID, they've seen the frequency of their trains reduce, sometimes from 4 trains an hour to 2 trains an hour. And then on top of that, they're seeing overcrowding as well. And at the same time that they're seeing a worse service, they're now seeing prices going up. So that's not fair. And quite rightly, you know, customers are complaining about that. So having a price rise at the same time really is a slap in the face when, you know, the experience that they're having on the trains isn't great. Now, look, at the end of the day, we want to encourage more people to use trains, you know, because it's much more environmentally friendly than using cars. So we need the train companies to start providing a better service. Now, the good news is that we do know that the Orbelio trains are going to be rolled out this year. So that will provide longer trains, which should ease some of the overcrowding. And because Southwest Trains are the first train company to go under Great British Rail, they will be doing a consultation later in the year to find out what the experiences of customers are. So what I will urge constituents to do is to actually, you know, to contribute to that survey so they can provide as much information as possible. And as soon as I find out about it, I will distribute the information as well.
You've just mentioned a few services within the rail service that need urgent action. How should the government respond? What should they do?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, so this is an interesting situation because obviously the, you know, you've got in the constituency, you've got two rail providers, Southern and Southwest Rail. So Southwest Rail is going to come under government ownership. So I think with this survey, this is going to provide an ideal opportunity for constituents to input to explain, you know, what's going on. And fundamentally, they, you know, constituents would like increased frequency and they would like a better service overall. So less overcrowding as well.
And how can MPs and local communities hold rail operators accountable for poor services?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, write your MP. I mean, I'm now part of what you call an all-party parliamentary group with South West Rail. So we are talking to them on a regular basis, and I've actually got a meeting next week. So I think the main thing you can do is continue to let me know, you know, what's going on, the experiences you're having, so we can actually directly input that to the company itself, and we can call for change where required.
And I'm curious to know what's happening with the rezoning of Epsom to Zone 6.
So this is something I have been talking to South West Rail about, but it is actually a TfL thing, and it's a cost issue. So this is something that will require further conversation. And obviously it's not something that, you know, TfL naturally want to do at the moment, because they'd actually lose money doing it. But it's something I've started a conversation about, and I think it's something we need to continue talking about, because it's obviously we're in quite an odd situation where we've got some stations that are, you know, within the zone, others that are out. It's just a bit of a mixed match in the constituency at the moment. And there are, you know, other places, you know, within the M25 who are seemingly further out from London who are in Zone 6, yet we're not. So I think it would be great if there was some equity, certainly in terms of, you know, the distance that we're located from London. And I'll continue conversations with Transport for London to see how that could be achieved.
And the final thing I want to talk about is the COVID memorial. What does the COVID memorial and the Book of Remembrance in Epsom Town Hall represent for the community in Epsom and Yule?
Yeah, look, I mean, obviously the Day of National Reflection is on Sunday, and this marks 5 years since the pandemic. And, you know, I think we've got to remember that, you know, the pandemic, I mean, it's hard to believe right now that it was 5 years since it happened, but so many people were affected, so many people died, and the pandemic continues still to have its impact. You know, we've got a number of individuals with long COVID, etc. So I think it's a great initiative by Epsom and Yule Borough Council, as we remember all of those who sadly lost their life during the pandemic, and we stand with the families of the bereaved. And I'll be visiting Epsom Town Hall later today to pay my own tributes.
And how do you think these memorials help families honour loved ones lost during the pandemic?
Well, I think it provides them with a focal point to go to remember. And so I think it's really helpful. And it's a place where they can, you know, gather with other individuals who've also lost loved ones.
And we have got memorial benches around the town as well. Final question. What message do you hope visitors take away from the memorials and benches in the town?
You know, well, I think on the Day of Reflection on Sunday, obviously it's an opportunity, you know, to sit and reflect. And it's a fantastic initiative by the Borough Council. And, you know, it's, as I said, it's just that moment to reflect and remember all those who sadly lost their life.